Welcome back, everyone, to Merge Conflict, your weekly developer podcast. I am James Montemagno.
And I'm Frank Krueger. What are you doing throwing the mic over to me? You never do that. Well, I think you taught me that I become full screen when I talk. So now I'm never going to stop talking so that I can be full screen throughout the whole episode. And on that note, back to you, James.
We're also testing the YouTube algorithm, because when we process the show that you can see at youtube.com/@mergeconflict.fm, it picks a bunch of random frames, and for some reason it always picks me, and we think it's the beginning, middle, and end, and apparently I talk in the middle, beginning, and end, so there's that. All right, quick update here. So we talked 2 weeks ago about me renting an EV. Do you remember that episode? I rented an EV.
I love that episode. I would talk about EVs every day, all day.
So Ryan said, next time, just as a point of comparison, I should try renting a Tesla. He said that the Teslas can put you in your route, tell you how much battery you want when you arrive in it. It'll route you to superchargers on the way. It all just works. It preheats the battery before you arrive. It only charges what you need. You plug in, you charge. All the money's taken care of on the car's computer. Charges the account automatically. It's hassle-free, blah, 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 blah. Well, Ryan, Teslas aren't available at Avis. Budget. Okay, that's my exclusive car rental agency of James Montemagno, not a sponsor. I think they're available at Hertz or whatnot, but is this Tesla experience that Ryan is describing, is that similar to your, you have a Chevrolet, is that correct?
Yeah, no, my understanding is, like, this is a terrible comparison, but I think everyone will understand. Tesla is the Apple of EVs. Everything's taken care of for you. Mm. Whereas if you get a non-Tesla, it's the Wild Wild West. I have, as follow-up to our EV episode, I went to a real city. I live on an island. I went to a real city and tried all the charging options. And by James, I mean all the charging options.
Yeah.
I took Craig's and your advice. I installed all the apps, and I was running around town doing like 30-minute charges on every kind of pump available in town. And boy, did I install a lot of apps. And every app was worse than the next one. And it got down to the point where you're just tapping to pay, because that was just easier.
Yeah.
It was terrible. Whereas they're starting to network too. So like, you'll get an app and it can actually do pumps for different apps. So you don't have to get that app. So the apps have app networks.
Mm.
It's and none of them have good mapping things where you can say, like, I want to go to New York City over the next 4 days, figure out a pump schedule for me.
Yeah.
Whereas I believe all of that is done for you in the Tesla world. And it's all very simple. But outside the Tesla world, it's the Wild Wild West.
I'm gonna vocalize what I'm doing for people that are listening to the audio version of this. Here's the percentage or excitement or up or chance that I'd ever buy a Tesla in my entire life. Zero. And I just here's from zero, 100% up top. I'm raising my hands up and I just lower them.
Okay.
All here's the chance I'm ever gonna buy a Tesla in my entire life. And I've ridden in Teslas. They're nice vehicles. Yeah. I would never buy one in my entire life. I'm short Tesla. That's not actually true. I'm not actually short Tesla. Like, I don't have short calls out on Tesla stock, but in my mind, short Tesla, because Tesla's a battery company. Okay. They're not actually a car company. They're a battery company that just happens to sell cars. Oops. That's my opinion. I could be wrong.
Fired. Okay.
Take that, Elon. Oh crap. Is he going to ban us on X? Oh no.
But also with EVs, it's a modern world and people are learning how to do manufacturing on the cheap and on the easy. So like, new California car companies are popping up. It's kind of a cool time in cars where they're just doing limited run EVs. It's kind of like, it's the Wild Wild West in EV world. I every so often at the pumps, I'll see a car I never even knew existed before.
That's cool.
It's super fun and cool. But yeah, I think Tesla's just killing it right now. But I love the competition. And yeah, it's more fun when there's different kinds of cars on the road. Because honestly, there's a lot of Teslas on the road right now.
A lot of Teslas. I mean, it's a nice vehicle, right? I have nothing against the vehicle. Yeah. I'm just short. I don't know. It's just not my jam. I rode in Hanselman's car recently and he's got a nice Tesla. And I don't know. Something about the screen. Here's my There are two things. Here's why.
Two things.
One, okay. I don't like the handles, the to get in and out of the cart. You got like press on them. Too confusing. The Ioniq, they swivel out. It's like, hey, let's get in this car, right? Now the Tesla's like, you try to figure out, dummy, how to get in this car, and I can never figure it out. And the second thing, that screen, too big. Just not that too kind. Big? I'm not that. It's too big. It's too big. Give me a car. Don't give me a screen. It's too ginormous. That's my opinion. Whatever. Tweet at me.
Look, okay, we are not doing a knocking Tesla show because they are fine cars, and I'm honesty.
Instead of knocking the Apple of Teslas, let's knock Apple themselves, Frank.
Oh, that's way more fun. Oh, what are we doing? Because this better not be a Vision episode, because I am still digging my Vision Pro. I still prefer the VR World update. We have to put an update in every episode. So we're not going to knock that part of Apple. What could you possibly have against dear old Apple?
Well, you know, sometimes Apple, they like to, they've done this in the past. This isn't the first time Apple's done this. I'm not saying that Apple's the only company that's done this, all right? Apple sometimes, they like to put out a bunch of previews. You know, they put out betas. Like, oh, here's beta 17, right? Of iOS 18, whatever the beta, blah, blah, blah. You've been testing it the entire way. Your app works great. Everything's gravy. And then they do a little gold master. And they're like, release is ready, go time. And then all of a sudden, stuff is broken. And you're like, what happened? And they're like, we just decided to change something last minute. Oh, we just decided to remove that newspaper kit thing from the thing. So now you got to recompile, do a thing. And then what the heck, Apple, why'd you do that?
It's for your safety and security, James. That's why they change things. Yeah. It's more secure this way.
Well, this time they decided to do this on macOS. macOS 14.4, which I highly recommend nobody install yet. Frank hasn't even installed it yet.
Well, yeah, I think we should actually headline this a little bit clearer here and make it broad things. Maybe don't install 14.4 right now, because you just informed me of this and I was a little bit shocked. So we're going to cover some things that broke in this operating system. And I'm a little bit shocked. I think you can handle it, but we'll get into it. Some big things broke, especially in the Java world. Java. Yeah. But also things broke in the .NET world, from what you tell me. And that's no bueno, no good.
And that's just what I've seen on the internet. There could be other, who knows what else has broken in this release of macOS 14.4. Now, I'm also a person that doesn't like to update. Like, I do update my iPhone. I'm on like beta builds all the time. So, whatever. But which has caused some things to break. In fact, like my Regal movie app, one time just like on iOS 16 betas, like didn't work for three betas. And then all of a sudden it started working again. All right, whatever happened. But I like to think that I improved the software and reported back to Apple whatever they broke. But this one is fascinating because, yes, they broke Java and some things of .NET. Now, you might be saying, well, I don't use anything Java or anything, you know, however .NET things that are on my machine. I don't even know what is broken, what is not broken and here. But significantly, they, for developers, broke substantial things for Java. In fact, it just doesn't work.
As a .NET developer, I run Java all the time because I develop for Android. And at some point, some Java gets run with I don't know, OpenJDK. I have actually no idea. I just, every IDE that's like download Android stuff, I'm like, get it. Give me all of it. I wish they could just change that dialogue to a giant OK button and just give me the Android. I don't need the dialogue box anymore. And am I wrong? That's Java stuff, right?
Yeah. You need Java. You need the JDK. That's a Java developer kit. You need all that stuff basically to work on your machine, especially for anything Android 100%. Yeah, if it's not downloading, it's not working.
Okay, so I think that's the big part of the PSA here is, hey, if you're doing any Android development, don't upgrade your Mac at the moment. Boy, I am curious. I got to read a little article, hopefully it'll be in the show notes here, about what actually broke on Java. And I would love to dig into it because it's one of my absolute favorite topics. It's JIT talk, talking about JITs. But do we want to mention also what's going on with the .NET first? Or
well, let's just dive into Java. The Java is the serious one, and the .NET one, I'm not sure how serious it is, but still serious enough that we should talk about. So you said you read this, and you said you understood it. Yeah. And you know me, I don't understand any. Well, actually, I do understand the SIG buses and the SIGVEVs and the SIGVEVs. That's kernel stuff that I've seen only because I've done iOS development and like when iOS development. Yeah.
User mode, baby.
I don't understand.
User mode.
Explain it to me, Frank. Explain it to me.
Well, we can't start there. That's a terrible place to start. We have to start with, we have to go to the basics, the transistor. No, I'm just kidding. Where we should start, though, is what is a JIT and how does a JIT actually work? Because they're kind of important. So a JIT takes your Java bytecode or your IL bytecode, depending on which runtime you're using, which is a vague machine code, but it's not actually the machine code for your machine, for your Intel machine or your M1 machine, whatever you got. What happens is when your app executes, every function that's called, they have to do a lookup. Have we compiled this function for the specific machine? If we haven't, then we need to compile it for the specific machine. And then we go and execute the code. That's what a JIT does, right? Is that an okay explanation?
Sounds about right, yeah. I approve. Approved.
Okay. So there's one expensive thing now, though. So you got two steps. Okay, so for every single function you call, now you have to go check a Boolean and then like do an if statement. That's just gross. That's like a lot of code. Every single function you call, that's a big overhead. It's a penalty for calling functions. Yeah. Mm-mm. So how do you solve that problem? How do you give no penalty for calling functions in a JIT world? How do you do it, James? You're on the spot. You're being paid by Microsoft 6, 7, 8 figures to solve this problem. What do you got?
Don't do the check and just do it?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Correct.
Problem solved. Boom.
So it's a fun little trick that they do. So every function pointer in the code to start with points to invalid memory of some sort or another. And so you just call that function. And if it's been JITted, if it's been compiled for that machine, the pointer will be correct and you will go and execute the correct function. If it hasn't been JITted yet, it will try to read invalid memory and the kernel, whatever, will throw up the processor, really, will throw up a nice little exception, an exception in the form of a signal, like a SIGV, whatever the heck, whatever signal it will put up for invalid memory access. So that's your connection between how a JIT works and why these signals are important. It's all optimizations. It's all just trying to make things run fast. And Java is stupidly fast. It's a good runtime. So they do all these optimizations. How's that explanation?
So, that was great. So, I mean, this has been working for years.
Ever.
Why did it stop now? If that's how it's worked forever and we have no issues.
Yeah. So Apple, in their wisdom, in a 0.3 to 0.4 upgrade, decided to change how that works. When you access invalid memory, it no longer posts those signals that the JVM is expecting. And I'm sorry, I haven't read all the details of it. I don't know if it's posting a different signal.
It is.
Or, yeah, it's a different signal. Okay. So, yeah, you got these poor Java apps waiting for an invalid memory signal, and instead they're getting a fancy new one that Apple thinks is better than the old ones.
Yes. So, previously it would send a SIGBUS or a SIGEV over to it. Now it's doing a SIGKILL. That's what apparently what it's being sent. So that signal cannot be handled by the process, and the process is unconditionally terminated. So that is what they're doing.
Oh, okay. That's even more nasty because you're not supposed to handle a SIG kill versus you can't handle a SIG kill. I don't remember the rules there. That's terrible. So that means this trick is completely off the board. because it says, there's no way to just catch that.
And it says specifically that in macOS 14.4, this occurs when a thread is operating in the write mode. If a memory access to the protected memory region is attempted, then it sends the sig kill instead.
So you can understand why Java would keep it in write mode, because they're jitting and they want to keep a buffer, because it's costly to allocate buffers, you know, allocate it, put it into write mode, put it into read mode. Those are all costly operations. You don't want to do it very often. So you can guess why they would want to keep it in write mode. Now, the funny thing here is, as far as I remember, this is totally how the .NET JIT also works. But for some reason, and I would love to dive into why .NET is not suffering from this. Because as far as I knew, this was a trick they were doing also. They used memory barriers all over the place. If you ever go read the actual .NET runtime, every other line of code is some kind of memory barrier or something to set up the right kind of memory security system that they need to get the signals that they need. Anyway, that's crazy. So Apple is just outright killing an app that tries to access invalid memory. Okay, there goes all my apps.
Well, why would Apple make this change? You said maybe it's some optimization or something that they did on their side, but it seems like a significant change for them to make in a point release.
I can only guess, but I half kid and always kid about it's for your safety and security. But imagine this scenario. Someone finds a way to overwrite a buffer in your app and is able to get the program counter to point at that buffer. Now an attacker has injected code into your app. So they have access to all the things that your app, all the memory that your app has allocated and done all that kind of stuff. So there's all sorts of tricks to detect that scenario. We pay the cost of it. Every one of our apps, every function call has overhead in it that protects the stack pointer as you enter and exit a function, just to detect these kinds of circumstances of people trying to attack your app by overwriting memory. So, okay, from Apple's perspective, you have writable memory that's also executable. I'm a little bit confused with the invalid memory flag here. I don't know if the JVM is pointing at memory that is writable but not executable, and therefore a flag gets risen, or if they're just trying to access, you know, something outside the address range, which also produces an error. Anyway, all that coming down to, there is an argument for writable memory, Apple being very selective of you trying to send the program counter to writable memory. They probably want you to set the flag to read only and executable for you to set the program counter to it.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's fascinating because it seems as though it hasn't hit the .NET side in the same way. There is specifically an open issue that core CLR inside of an LLDB plugin fails to initialize a runtime specifically on Mac OS 14. And our good friend Rolf is in here as well talking about this. As well, it seems really, really deep level on some things, and specifically in .NET diagnostics, they are talking about this as well. I'd love to get the team on to talk about how this is handled in general, or something deeper level going on. And then they mentioned the Java bug as well, but it doesn't seem as though whatever is handling, or however .NET is handling these things, or it goes through a different specific layer. And if you look, it looks like the JVM folks, if they call pthread write protect np, that is what is causing to kill the process with the sig kill instead of the sig bus. So I think what's fascinating about that is, and they actually have a memory sample. This is actually really kind of cool. I'm going to link specifically to this link, and I'll put it in there as well. But this one is showing the code to reproduce it. And it's like very minimal to do it as well. There's some mem mapping and things like that happening inside of it. It's just kind of like interesting to read the code that would call it in general. But yeah, I'm just curious if like maybe .NET just never does it go down this specific call that the JIT is doing. Maybe it's doing something else instead of the write protect, or maybe it is handling it in a different way.
Yeah, like I said, who knows? You'd have to really dig into the runtime to find out, but I can imagine a million scenarios. Like they queue up a bunch of JITted methods until they have a page worth of memory. And then they lock that buffer and then set that executable and then execute the page. So you can do it by delaying the act for a long time. It really gets down to what trick do you want to use with that detection. Am I calling a JITted method or am I calling a runtime method? As far as I know, the RyuJIT will happily rejit methods as it sees fit. It's running heuristics all the time to see the performance of things and deciding what it should do. And if it's capable of re-emitting a function, it's basically capable of rewriting the whole call graph as needed. So I imagine there's already a whole nother set of tricks that's being implemented by the .NET JIT that's probably just working around this problem because they just don't do it this exact same way as Java.
Yeah. Well, what if I told you, Frank, that Apple also decided to change some other error message that they were reporting?
So they're just angry about error messages in this release, huh? The .4, we're fixing our error. No, the last one, it's not an error message, the other one. It's that sig kill, that's aggressive. That's just, you touched the wrong memory. We're shutting you down all the way. That's crazy. I think what you're going to bring up is a little less nasty, but more nasty in the sense of, oh God, you have to deal with certificates.
Yeah, this one to me is a little fascinating because it's something you do probably more active if you're a ASP.NET Core developer, which is often create HTTPS certs. And specifically, you can create dev certs. And in fact, you have to create a dev cert when you're literally on your machine for the first time. Use .NET dev certs and it'll generate a self-signed cert for ASP.NET Core during local development, right? So you can do HTTPS. Apparently, Apple has decided to change the error code that when you export the HTTPS on macOS 14.4. So specifically, they used to report some error message and they just decided to change it in this one. They're like, they're going to just change the code that they get back when a failed data key export occurs. And in the code of .NET, it wasn't handling the specific code that didn't exist magically before and then failed.
This is bad on Apple, but can I give a... Okay, I'm really terrible here. The fact that .NET little development server is able to make HTTPS work at all is to me some kind of small miracle. I'm still amazed every time it happens. It's like, you can just go to this HTTPS thing. I'm like, I can? And then it works. And I'm like, what black magic did you do? And it turns out they were relying on some kind of system thing that returns error codes or something to make these dev certs. Like every year or so, it's like, you got to update your dev certs. And I'm like, accept, yes, whatever. Update my stupid dev certs. Don't ask me about this. Just do it. And then everything just works. I kind of love that part of the .NET run part. But dang. So Apple changed their error code for our safety and security. What did they change the error code from to? Anything interesting?
It used to be error sec passphrase required. I guess that's what they always return. Now they return a sec invalid key attribute mask. Maybe they're just getting more specific onto what happened. You know what I mean?
Well, and this bug, I read a little bit of it, was even grosser than all this error message stuff. Like, it was also, they were using the error message to detect whether they should use a fallback code path also. Yeah. So it was more like you're trying to figure out what version of the stupid security system that you're talking to.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, .NET devs. That stinks. That's the worst part of maintaining a runtime, is dealing with this kind of stuff. And I don't know, Apple, was it worth it? Don't you know my philosophy, never break code. If once it's been published, it's permanent. It's in stone. Unless there's a crashing bug.
Or don't do it in a point release. And specifically, don't have it so it works in all the betas and then doesn't work in the final release. I just think that the diff between, you know, RC2 and GM Goldmaster needs to be negligible, right? You can't.
Yes, I agree.
Bug fixes only.
Under the assumption that, like, it's someone's job to keep up with the points, because I keep up with the points in that when I feel like it, I upgrade my Mac, and then the apps I use are I check, like, you know, all the iCircuits get checked and all the Calcas get checked because I use them all the time.
Yes.
Everything else, gosh, you assume point releases are just going to be safe. Like, it's bad enough in September having to test all my apps against the new versions of everything.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep up with the point releases. Who's got time for that? No, not me.
Yeah, it seems like the .NET one at least doesn't have implications, or doesn't seem like it has implications against running apps, which is good, where the Java one does. So that one seems a lot worse. In general, I mean, they're both bad, but you know, nobody's perfect. Okay. Nobody's perfect.
Oh, I wonder. So I was about to make an argument to myself. It was a reminder that I should be using dev containers whenever I'm doing ASP.NET development. It's just better. Like, it's pretty seamless when it's working. And it working can sometimes be hard, but whatever. But I bet you would still have the, dev cert issue, huh? Because it's my Safari that has to make the request, so it's my Safari that needs to have the certs installed. So maybe it still would have been an issue, but I still think half of the answer would have been keep using dev containers, because then you can just have a silly little Alpine Linux version of whatever running.
That's true, and you could always bring it into a code space, which would then be running just on a Linux machine somewhere, which is also substantial. Or you could use a dev box, and that's an entire optimized VM. I guess that's only Windows, though, so you don't get a Mac. But
is that right? You know. Okay. Yeah. I need to go to a talk, or I need a lecture. You need to put out a video, or you have to point me to a video you've already created, James, because you created a video on everything. How do I take my dev container and turn it into a code space box that you just told me about?
Here's the cool part about that. Okay, so there's there's three things. Two of them are connected, and one of them aren't. So let's say you have a dev container just on your local machine. Basically, what that does is it will configures everything in a container. All of your, so you can say, oh, I want .NET 6 in this. I want this. It's a container of your machine, what your app needs to build, basically, right?
Let me interrupt you, because it's so important that I just love it. You're building an operating system just for your little compiling your app. I love it, because then you don't have to deal with versions or anything. And I really want to make a pitch. I think Rich Lander is probably working on something like this, but I want to just ship all my .NET apps as the full VM and just have it run my app. Anyway, moving on. Dev containers, please continue.
So a dev container, you can just like be on your local VS Code machine. You say, hey, like in VS Code, don't use my machine. Like don't use the stuff on my machine. Use the stuff in this container, and it's got all the stuff that you need to do the stuff, right? Bingo, bango. You can just check that dev container into source control. It's just a JSON file configuration. When you do that, you can go on to GitHub and you can say open in a code space. If you don't have a dev container, it'll spin up a generic code space dev container. But what you can do then is say, give me a code space that uses your dev container. And then that won't be on your machine. It'll be hosted in a you know, a VM, a Linux VM thingy machine somewhere, and then you're doing everything in the browser. Now, on top of that, Frank, let me tell you what this is.
Such an idiot. I'm sorry. I just have to interrupt you. I'm such an idiot. I never realized you could just do it through GitHub. But please continue. I'm just going to wallow in my idiocy over here.
Now, check this out, though. This is where it gets even better. Now, when you are in VS Code using a dev container local in your machine, you need Docker. You need your machine. Yes. It's going to be doing stuff, right? But what if I told you that you can create your code space online using your configuration, and then you can open that code space inside of VS Code. So you're using your VS Code setup, right? And all of your plugins, all this stuff that you want, but actually you're developing inside of your code space on the internet. And then when you compile it, you compile in the code space that you're connected to automatically, which is amazing.
I know this is like 5-year-old technology, but I really need to take advantage of this more. It's really kind of magical, all that kind of stuff, because you can just spin up any environment you need and not deal with the stupid machine configuration.
Yeah. Then
absolutely genius.
The last thing though is, let's say you actually need an entire rig, right? You need a workstation. Oh, you know what I mean?
Okay, we're getting excessive, but yes, sometimes I do. Sometimes I need 2 rigs, James.
Maybe you need 5 rigs, and maybe you need each of those rigs to be basically different apps that are highly customized for each of those apps that you're going to log into. And you can maybe swipe through them as virtual desktops on your machine. Well, that's where DevBox comes in. And DevBox, it's a Windows experience, but it's basically a cloud-based workstation. So it's like a VM, but like amped up for developers. You get these super powerful, beefy machines that are hyper-optimized for development workloads. And when you spin it up, it just has all of your stuff and you can configure it. So you can say, hey, just like you were configuring the dev container, you can configure DevBox to be like, here's all my dependencies, all this stuff, right? So when I do .NET Aspire work, and I work on eShop, which is a huge app with it's got like 20 projects in it and like all these containers and all these microservices. I'm not going to do it on my little M1 machine. I'm going to do it on a dev box that has 128 gigs of RAM. It's got like 10 terabytes of that. And it's like the most powerful computer in the world, right? Compared to like my little tiny machine. And that's where dev box comes in. Yeah.
You are killing me. Okay. We might do an episode on it because your sales pitch has won me over.
One Microsoft. There we go. So
I'm just enjoying my lowly little dev containers at the moment, but it's good to know that the horizon is vast and beautiful and far.
It's out there. Away. It's out there. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this action-packed merge conflict that didn't break your machine at all by listening to it or watching it. I am feeling a little bit better, in case people were asking. We recorded this on Tuesday, just 2 days later.
You sound better.
I woke up this morning. This is Tuesday, the 19th. I woke up terrible. It was just like I was feeling better yesterday. Woke up today. I was just coughing for like an hour straight. I have no idea. But then as the day went on, as I drank more tea, was better. I barely coughed during this podcast, which is good. So overall, feeling better. I'm hoping tomorrow. Let's do it.
You don't push these things. Enjoy the illness.
Yeah.
Let it linger.
No, I refuse. I refuse. All right. Well, that's going to do for this week's Merge Conflict. So until next time, I'm James Montemagno.
And I'm Frank Krueger. Thanks for watching and listening.
Peace.